From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. Thank you so much for being here with us this evening. I'm your host, Jason Dole. But not for long. I'm about to hand things over to Bill Williams, because it's time once again for the Kingfisher Project, Information Against Addiction, only here on Radio Catskill's Local Edition.
Welcome to the Kingfisher Project, information and awareness about the heroin and opiate epidemic. I'm Julie Pizzol. The Kingfisher Project began in memory of my daughter, Rebecca Jean Pizzol, who was shot and killed due to her heroin addiction. At her memorial service, her former teacher, Mr. Okazalik, read an essay she wrote. It was about a bird, an injured kingfisher bird that she found and rescued when everyone else had given up on the bird. In that spirit, our community came together and formed the Kingfisher Project. Since 2014, we have been raising awareness about the drug and opiate crisis in our listening area and around the country, right here on Radio Catskill. Here is Bill Williams.
Thanks, Julie. My guest this evening is Jessica Hoppe. Jessica is a Honduran Ecuadorian writer and the creator of At Nueva Yorca on Instagram. She's been featured on ABC News. Her work has appeared in the Latino Book Review, in the New York Times, Vogue, and elsewhere. She was a board member of Time of Butterflies, a nonprofit supporting families through domestic abuse recovery, and is an organizer with the Sent Am and Ismin Writers Group. She lives in New York City. Jessica's memoir, First in the Family, A Story of Survival, Recovery, and the American Dream, was published in September. Carl Eric Fisher, a former guest on this program, wrote about Jessica's book, quote, First in the Family sings with love and shouts with rage, offering an uplifting document of resilience and recovery, even while calling out the seductive dangers of the American dream. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you so much. What a beautiful introduction using Carl's quote. It is my favorite one. I really love that.
It's through Carl that I first became aware of you when we were both at this Flourishing After Recovery workshop.
Yes.
How did you first, I read about his book and just sent him an email and said, hey, you want to be on my show? And he graciously responded. I'm curious how you came across him.
Yes, well, I loved his book, The Urge, and I used it extensively in my own research. It really just broadened the aperture of my understanding. Historically, I love history, and I got so much out of it, particularly the history of AA and its founders and its relationship in sort of being proliferated around the world and how that occurred. I thought that was fascinating, and his personal story as well. I was able to attend a panel at Columbia here in New York, where I live, and I once again was able to hear him in conversation leading a panel, and I did what I sort of have done throughout my career, which is just to ask him to sign my book and tell him how much I appreciated his work. And from there, we've been in touch. I love his newsletter and all of his offerings. I love the pedagogy, the lens of his work in thinking about recovery as flourishing and how I relate to that. It's been really, really insightful and helpful to me in my recovery. So I'm very grateful for his work.
Yeah, I find it a seminal piece. I refer to it all the time. And that's one of the things that impresses me about your book, like his and like work by Maya Solovitz. All three of you talk about your recovery, but you talk about it in the context of history.
Oh, thank you for mentioning Maya. I love her as well. Oh, I'm so happy to be named in that group. Yes, thank you. That's a high
compliment. She's been a guest on this show, and then I'll show off and then I'll shut up.
No, please, continue.
Another guest who you also mentioned in your book is Sheila Vicaria.
Mm-hmm. Love her. Great work as well. Loved her book, Harm Reduction.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And the work of the Drug Policy Alliance. Really, really important.
Let's get down to it. What about you as a writer? Give us some history of you as a writer. I know a little bit. I know about the beginning. I know when you were in grade school and having to hold a pencil properly.
Yes.
Might not have been the beginning, but it might have been the first obstacle you had to overcome. Who knows?
I do. Yeah, I do see it as the beginning. I really do, because I was always very creative. I was always just very, very curious about people and how they communicated with each other and how we interacted with each other, how we loved each other. So my first, I think, yeah, my writing began with just sort of observing my family. And I grew up in a bilingual home. And so the language that was used was often like very much interchanged. And Spanglish is a very vibrant and alive sort of way of communicating. And I loved particularly how, well, both my parents really used the language and used words. I think one of the most, one of my favorite parts of my book is sort of dissecting, looking at the etymology and then the deeper meaning, the clinical significance and the historical relevance of my mom's use of this word desalmado, which means sort of separated from one's soul. So alma means soul. And this suggested that she was using it to refer to my grandfather, her father, as a soulless person. And I felt that I could not recall her using that word up until that point. And I was a couple of years into my sobriety and a grown woman by that time. And all of my life, I couldn't recall another time that she'd used it. And I just became so fascinated by that and thinking about it within the context of recovery and sort of some of the mythological stories behind the power of alcohol, the power of drugs to sort of, you know, inhabit our bodies and animate something hidden deep within us that maybe in our conscious life we're not able to access, or that we're, in my case, suppressing. I think it started as a very young child writing and thinking and contemplating these things, observing. I was always very observant. And I think, you know, that is definitely the germ, the beginning there of that. But I did, as you said, thank you for reading the book so carefully and so thoughtfully. As a young child, I did show signs early on of dyslexia and ADHD, which definitely came for me like a vengeance while writing this book. And that is very common for people who also suffer from substance use disorder.
The number of times when I talk to people about their addiction and ADHD comes up is a lot.
Yeah, it's very high. Yeah, it's difficult. And I think, you know, my book moves into the pressures of the American dream and sort of the models of achievement and high achievement and achievement, you know, as being representative of your value and your worth in society, in families, and even in us, in ourselves personally. You know, we've internalized a lot of ideas, at least for me, I will speak for myself. And especially as the daughter of Honduran and Ecuadorian immigrants, you know, it really was very much, I was very aware of that pressure, that there were opportunities that were withheld, you know, that my parents were marginalized and there was quite a bit of oppression and discrimination. And I was going to sort of right those wrongs, and I was going to have the opportunity through their sacrifices to be able to do that. And that it was something I realized as an adult, of course, that was a pain that I could not heal. Those were wounds that were not my fault, and therefore they couldn't ever be my responsibility, although I really wanted the opportunity to have my parents understand that and have our relationship grow more deeply through understanding that, sort of removing the internalized stigmas and the internalized pressure, and sort of have a way of loving ourselves based on, you know, what we believe and feel, and love each other, you know, from that perspective as well, as opposed to the things that we've internalized.
Let me go back a little bit. How sophisticated, when you were dealing with dyslexia, how sophisticated was the school system in helping you out in any way?
They were quite sophisticated. It was a matter of, I think the thing was at Mendham, you know, it was very well known, like Mendham is an affluent area, and therefore the public schools were, you know, quite similar to a private school, you know, very small classes. People, there were high expectations, and I when my teacher, you know, spoke to, as I read about my book, spoke to my mother, my father in particular was reticent and he was afraid. He didn't want me to be labeled and he didn't want me to be put sort of, you know, in a remedial course or that that hold me back in any way. And so what I write about is, yeah, exactly. What I write about is that, you know, I don't blame him for that at all. That makes a lot of sense to me, like looking at it from his perspective. However, it was that the poison of that narrative, right, that you know, would not allow him to get the assistance that he needed. And now I would have the same fate, you know, because of this marginalization that occurs. I will say, too, I needed assistance that many of the students that I went to school with did not need. And so, therefore, it wasn't very obvious to teachers and administrators that they would need to provide that. And there wasn't a lot of desire to provide that for me. You know, things like financial aid and, you know, programs that could have, you know, looking up scholarships and things like that, which would have been so helpful. They just weren't in place because these weren't things that a lot of the students needed. Or if they did, I wasn't aware of them. I was aware of the affluence that surrounded me and the opportunity therein. And I thought I needed to just keep up with the Joneses, you know, and that really was my parents' perspective as well. We were doing the best we could to keep up. And the idea was, you know, get to college. And that was going to be, you know, the leap from one generation to the next, that it would be secured in getting a college degree.
When you say from one generation to the next, any thoughts whether anybody else in your family, whether there was dyslexia in prior generations?
Absolutely. When I talk to my family now, I'm like, do you know what this is right now? Like, even in this conversation, it's evident, you know, you know, my mother, my father, they often just like jump from one, you know, conversation to the next. And then, you know, all of a sudden it's turned and is a totally different topic or, you know, we're not entirely conversing. It's sort of like I'm saying one thing and you're not getting that ping pong back. It's not like the rally in tennis. It's like, you know, it's like just gone the other way and totally diverted. So yes, there's a long history of neurodivergence in my family. Also a lot of mental illness, schizophrenia. We also have epilepsy. I mean, you name it. It's there. It's just that we didn't have the language to discuss what was, you know, ailing us. It was just sort of, it was used in different language, you know, sort of like locura or, you know, it was just a way of sort of contextualizing things and making them more broad. And so, and also what I discovered a lot about that is not a matter of ignorance or not understanding. It is literally a withholding, which is, you know, part of the American project. And it's also, it's just to avoid the very real and damaging consequences of having stigma apply to you or your family, you know? So if it was known that if we did sort of own that we were suffering from a certain mental health disorder, you know, we could be very easily labeled and that could make us a target. So that was something that understanding, you know, I wasn't so much blaming my family of God, you know, why didn't we know this? Why didn't we have this information? And that is how I felt in the initial days of my recovery, in the initial months and, you know, years. And then I started to learn more about how people of color are treated and how the war on drugs and the racialization and criminalization of drug use really, really affected my family story and my ability to recover.
I'm Bill Williams, and I'm talking with Jessica Hoppe here on the Kingfisher Project. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
A Election coverage continues on Radio Catskill this week with Meet the Candidate interviews for New York's 51st Senate District, which covers all of Sullivan, Delaware, Schoharie, and Otsego counties and parts of Ulster, Broome, and Chenango counties. Join us Thursday on the Local Edition when we talk to Republican incumbent Senator Peter Oberacker, but first, tomorrow night, it's our interview with Democrat Michelle Frazier, the challenger looking to represent New York's 51st. That's the Local Edition, tomorrow night at 6 on Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
Music from a musician's perspective. I'm Kathy Geary, and on Now and Then, we explore the artistry of the singer-songwriter. Now and Then, Saturday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Welcome back to the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition. I'm your host, Bill Williams, and I'm talking with Jessica Hoppe about her brand new memoir, First in the Family, a story of survival, recovery, and the American dream.
As a youngster in grade school, middle school, high school, did you keep a journal? Did you write a lot?
Sometimes. You know, my mother had some of our childhood photos and things, personal items, in a storage facility, and she recently went into it to recover what was there. We all had no idea really what she would find. And she found this portrait that I painted my freshman year of high school. And if I do say so myself, it's quite good. Writing a diary would be quite dangerous because my mom was very strict and she was pretty nosy. So if she found something like a diary, she would take care of it. Maybe not my father, but my mother for sure. So you probably didn't want written evidence. But certainly I did write, I did have a practice very much like morning pages. High school and school was quite painful for me, I have to be honest. So I did refer, you know, to fantasy, to having a life inside my imagination. I was very close with my sisters. it was a difficult time for me. But I did remain very creative, and I had a whole world inside my mind, an idea, a fantasy very much taken from my parents that all would be well once I was able to get out of this small town that didn't very much accept me or see me for who I was. But turns out that's a myth too. I needed to find that peace and that sense of home within myself. But that is a long journey for most people. So I do bring, you know, some grace to that.
When did you begin your memoir? What are the book's origins?
Well, I was trying to be a writer for quite some time. I was trying to get published a lot. I think the way that it's described as being a writer, you know, a published author through non-traditional pathways, meaning I don't have an MFA. I do live in New York City, which is a great privilege, particularly when it comes to publishing, because it is widely known as sort of the center of publishing in many ways, because a lot of the houses are here and many writers live here. Therefore, there are a lot of readings and there are a lot of workshops and events where one could listen to publishing experts, writers themselves. And so I sort of got to work learning about the industry that way. After college, I got an internship in fashion working for Ralph Lauren. And after the economic crash in 2008, I think fashion is very notoriously, like all of the creative, like publishing too, you know, very low paying. And so I wasn't able to sustain my career in fashion. And I didn't know. I also felt in fashion, I had an idea of it being sort of a dream job. And when I entered, I realized that it was very unfulfilling to me in many ways. But I felt I had made such a sacrifice financially, emotionally, spiritually to get to that job. There wasn't really entitled to to leave it or to change course. I didn't know how to change course. And then, of course, life pushed me out, and I was forced to leave that job. I wasn't making it financially. So that really put me in a position to ask myself what I wanted. And I was writing again privately on a blog, and these things were kind of popular in that time. They still are, right? It's more about social media. And so I was writing, and that was a way of practicing every day writing. And then I was like, well, I want to be published. So I'd go into some workshops to learn how people do that, to learn who the editors, you know, who the gatekeepers were in that realm. And I did. I started writing. Oftentimes, I would have to wait until times like now, like Hispanic Heritage Month, to have anyone consider my story at all. So I started building a platform on social media. It's called Nueva Yorka, which you read in my bio. And I just wanted a place to sort of share my thoughts, share my creativity, self-expression, without having to ask permission. And that built out a nice audience, and people started following my story, but it was still very much about being, you know, a New York girl who has it all together. And meanwhile, my substance use disorder was escalating very quickly and very seriously. And so it was my social media where I decided to be honest about myself. And then that opened a whole new pathway for my writing and for my platform as well. Some people really liked it, other people defected, and that was fine. But making that hard turn has been tricky, but I find that the people who were really deeply engaged in my story really appreciated the honesty in my sharing, that I had been in recovery and that I wanted to be honest about that, and I wanted to be helpful in destigmatizing the disorder.
Let's talk about your story a little more. Mm-hmm. When I read the book, the first time through, the first imagery that came to me was Russian dolls, one tucked inside the other.
Oh, cool.
So there's your story, and then there's the family story, and then the larger social story. And then I went to a different metaphor, which is, seems to me the structure of the book is a little bit like you had a zoom lens, and you started from the outside. You watched from far away, closed into your family, closed into yourself. And then once you started dealing with yourself in recovery, you opened back up to the family and then ultimately back to the world at large and helping to change things.
That's lovely. Yes, exactly. Thank you. You get it. You're right on the money, Bill.
Was that structure intentional? Or because it's, in your introduction, you talk about, well, these are some, you make it sound like everything is haphazard. This, I'm going to write about this, and then I'll write about that. And I don't think it's quite as haphazard as your introduction makes it sound.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. I didn't think so, but some of the feedback was that it was a bit fragmented, and I think certainly in some parts, yes, particularly in sort of my coming into awareness about my substance use disorder, right, and some of the childhood memories, which it can be difficult to reach back that far into your childhood. And, of course, memory is your perspective, and so it can't be, it can't be retold with 100% accuracy by, everyone's, perspective. So I did the very best that I could. And but my mission, yes, from the beginning was to tell this meta story and to use my personal history and my family's in order to contextualize that for people. Because oftentimes when you try and make a statement or you have a thesis that might sound, like it might sound sort of conceptual, which is that I'm using my book to interrogate the American dream as the ultimate gateway drug. Okay, so what do I mean by that? I mean that I wanted to get to the root of what was ailing my family, the illness, and that was pain. and what was that pain being passed down? You know, it was more than bad actors. It was more than these few people who were addicts were bad guys, you know what I mean? Or bad people. And so we should just stay away from them in the family, or we should sweep that under the rug and never talk about it and just try and be, you know, the quote, good people and the good citizens and, you know, the model minority. That wasn't going to work. Everyone in our family had a story, and had a story well beyond what was being shared and passed down. I wanted to get to the truth of that, to the root of it. And that was extremely relevant to me personally. And I felt that it could be sort of a blueprint for understanding, like I write in the book, just as you must understand how a drug operates within your body, so too must you understand how systems of domination are at work in your life. So how had white supremacy affected me throughout my life? How had misogyny, you know, poured its way into our family and making, you know, life sort of unlivable, conditions unlivable and very dangerous for many of the women, for any of the queer people in my family? These were things that needed to be eradicated. But we had to be in a place where we could be honest, where we could have the language in order to name something, because you can't deal with something if you can't name it, if it doesn't take a realistic sort of life form. And so I set about to name some of the things, and this was very triggering for my family. It was very upsetting, you know, the loss of our house, you know, naming that as you know, enduring a period of housing insecurity, a period of homelessness was very upsetting to my mother. But I did ask her, you know, gently, what would you call it? You know, and she didn't have an answer. There wasn't an easier, softer way. But acknowledging that that was what occurred, and that that was no fault of her own or my father's, it really was a healing balm, you know? It was just a relief, I think, because there's such a weighted pressure of feeling as if some of the things that occurred that were a result of oppression or racism or, you know, our social structures, you take that upon yourself. And that's incredibly shameful. To be relieved of that and to understand how the system works, and to know that your basic needs are human needs and they should be provided for. And if you are working, you know, your tail off,
yeah,
you should be able to have enough to live and provide for your family. And not having those things is incredibly toxic. And believing that you're at fault for that is also toxic. And so it makes a lot of sense that a lot of people were like me, you know, that the coping mechanism manifested in substance use disorder, that it didn't manifest in that same exact way for the other people in my immediate family, illustrated the stigma, the particular stigma attached to substance use disorder. And what I wanted was to bring us all sort of shoulder to shoulder and not make addiction this like vilified, separate thing, to bring it in and understand this is a part of our family history. These are the reasons why, and this is how we sort of turn the page and talk about this realistically. I wanted them to be acquainted with the facts, with the reality, because that was so much more liberating for me and also for them.
You've been listening to Jessica Hoppe talk about her new memoir, First in the Family, a story of survival, recovery, and the American dream. Thank you for joining us, Jessica.
Thank you so much, Bill. I hope to be back. Book two.
Okay. That's all we have time for on the air today. You'll want to catch our full conversation on the Kingfisher Project podcast at wjffradio.org, only from Radio Catskill. Have a good evening.
Thank you so much, Bill. And as Bill Williams just said, that was just a portion of the interview that he did with Jessica Hoppe. The full interview is up at wjffradio.org. Subscribe to the Kingfisher podcast so you can hear Bill's monthly interviews in their full unedited form, or just come back here about the first Tuesday of every month. Next month, Kingfisher Project won't be on the first Tuesday because the first Tuesday is Election Day. We'll be having election coverage. Bill will be on the following week. Hey, election coverage continues here on Radio Catskill. Tomorrow on the local edition, we continue our interviews with the candidates, this time with New York's 51st Senate District. We'll be talking to the Democratic challenger, Michelle Frazier. That's tomorrow evening on the local edition. And then coming up later on tonight at 9, it's the CBS News Vice Presidential Debate simulcast presented by NPR with analysis from NPR to follow. That's coming up at 9. Up next, it's the